Hi, this is Paul, and I have a conversation today that I've very much been looking forward to. I'm talking to Brett Sokold, who has written this terrific book that, by virtue of the title and the subject, many of you might not be tempted to read but should. And I will say it that way because I think this book has, I think this book is incredibly valuable for a lot of the work that I'm doing. So Brett, I thank you so much for being willing to talk and for sending me this book and you initiated this and I am so glad you did. Why don't you introduce yourself a little bit? Tell us who you are. And then I'll just keep asking you questions.
Sure. Yeah, no, that sounds great. And thanks so much for having me. It's exciting to be on here and to find people who want to talk about my book. So I'm delighted. So my name is Brett Sokold. I work for the Roman Catholic Archdiocese in Regina, Saskatchewan, Canada. I'm the archdiocesan theologian here, which means you wear a bunch of hats with that. My main task is I'm in charge of our diaconate formation program, and I do other teaching and writing. Because it's not a university context, I kind of teach intro everything. So, you know, when you're doing with sort of adult ed kind of stuff, right? With deacon candidates or lay formation people, it's intro theology, intro Christology, intro scripture, intro ethics, intro everything. There's an interesting story with the book. When I was doing my doctorate and I was looking for a topic, I was working with my mentor, to whom the book is dedicated, Margaret O'Gara. And, we were looking for a topic that would give me sort of a wide scope to think about theology in general and give me tools to be a good theological teacher. And when we stumbled across transubstantiation, somehow we both knew that that would work. Now, that will seem crazy on the surface, but maybe some of the conversation today will show how some of the basic problems that underlay Catholic-Protestant disagreement about transubstantiation go to deeper questions about worldview that have application across a whole range of theological questions. And so it's actually been very helpful for thinking about even surprisingly enough, intro scripture, but certainly intro theology, the relationship between faith and reason, all those kinds of things. So, so that's a little bit about me. I'm a family man. We just had little Martha is 6 weeks old, and so she's number seven.
Oh,
so,
wow.
So we're busy.
You've outdone me. I only had five.
Okay, only five. Yeah. We never had five. We went from four direct to six. We're still recovering from that. So,
imagine.
Yeah.
What's the age span with your children?
My oldest just turned 13.
Okay.
So we don't have one with a license yet, but I'm told that that's a game changer when the oldest gets their license. Because right now we're in the game of like, how many activities can you get to on a Saturday?
What kind, are you homeschooling, Catholic school? What are you doing for education?
Now we're homeschooling. Okay. And that's going very well. My wife manages that. Her name is Flannery. So some people might recognize that name. She's named for Flannery O'Connor. I didn't name her, but her parents were reading Flannery O'Connor. And in Saskatchewan, actually, we have a great arrangement, at least works well for us. Our homeschoolers register through our local public school system, which means that our kids can play on the sports team, they can be in the band program. Once they get to high school, they can take one course per semester at the local high school. Wow. So if you don't want to set up a chem lab in your kitchen, your kid can go take chemistry at the local high school. And our local Catholic school, we have publicly funded Catholic schools here in Saskatchewan. So we register through Regina Catholic, and they've been really excellent with the homeschool community. So that's been a great blessing, because some of the things you miss out on with schools, you know, band or soccer team or whatever, we don't. And we can even take advantage of something like a chem lab in high school. So it's been really great for us, and the kids are really thriving. And yeah.
Wow. That sounds ideal. That really sounds tremendous.
It's a nice gig. Yeah.
well, let for a lot of the Protestants out there, when you talk about diaconate formation, a lot of Protestants hear that. Well, let's say someone from the Christian Reformed Church like myself, and wow, that's a lot for deacons. But the Roman Catholic Church, a deacon is a very different thing than a deacon is in the Christian Reformed Church. To some degree. Why don't you flesh that out a little bit?
Yeah. So our deacons are clerics. We would say they're members of the clergy. They're ordained. All of our priests and bishops are ordained deacons, but right, they'll typically spend a year as a deacon before they're ordained as a priest. So it's part of a sort of the threefold ministry of orders that we see in the later books of the New Testament of diaconate, presbyterate, episcopate. We sort of follow that. Now that's been sort of recovered since Vatican II. In the early church, there were deacons and presbyters, or what we call priests, and bishops, episcopoi. But deacons sort of slowly died out and were sort of absorbed into the priesthood, because originally you weren't ordained a deacon and then a priest. They were quite separate things. And then diaconate got subsumed into priesthood. And with Vatican II, we looked back at the early church and said, well, no, diaconate deserves its own thing. So now we have this technical distinction between a permanent deacon, who is someone who is often married, and not on the track to priesthood, and a transitional deacon, who is someone who's spending that sort of generally 1 year period in their formation on their way to priesthood. But yeah, they have a very specific liturgical role. They can preach, and then a big part of their role is to sort of sacramentally represent to the Christian community the relationship between worship and service. So they have a role in the liturgy, and then they have a role generally outside the walls of the church, where it's, you know, maybe in the rough part of town, maybe in the prisons, maybe in the hospitals, sometimes in quite creative ways. I know a couple guys who do ministry on ships. So sailors who are coming into port, who haven't seen their families or a church for months, maybe. But outside the walls of the church, and then their ministry demonstrates for all of us that our worship should lead to service, and our experience of service in the world drives us back to praise God and to find our strength in God, because sometimes ministry in the world wears you out. So there's that kind of dynamic between worship and service, that the deacon is kind of the sacramental representation of that for us.
Okay. Well, that's wonderful. I love how you set that whole thing up. Now, so you're doing essentially theological formation and preparation for deacons. What sort of course do they undergo in this process?
Right. We do a 4-year program, which is fairly typical. And these guys are people with day jobs and families, so it's an evenings and weekends kind of thing. And so we run a weekend formation program, and on a given weekend, we'll have myself or other presenters trying to cover a whole sort of curriculum of formation that would be similar to what lots of people in pastoral ministry would go through in Protestant or Catholic context. So you'll have scripture, you'll have some intro philosophy, you'll get into theology, but then you'll also get into the pastoral care elements, so pastoral counseling, or things like different kinds of ministry to the poor or in healthcare context or whatever. We'll have, you know, people who do chaplaincy in those contexts come in and share their expertise. And then we have sort of a practicum, where essentially the practicum is like, you learn how to listen. Because in any pastoral ministry you do, I don't care where it is.
Yeah.
Listening is like a really key skill. So, we do that. What else? I mean, we have to know some canon law in a Catholic context. So a wide range of those kinds of things, but they're not typically university courses, though in our context, some of our guys are doing some distance ed on the side. Like, we're a long way from the nearest seminary or theological faculty, which is why it makes sense to have me on staff at the diocese. If you lived in Edmonton or Toronto, you just ask the seminary to do this work for you. But if you live in Regina, you don't have that option. So But we do some distance learning through a theological college in Edmonton. It's a little flexible. More academically inclined people can do more of that. But at the local level, I'll make sure everyone's got at least the basics kind of thing. So,
okay. Okay. What are the numbers like in terms of ratios in North America between deacons and priests? Do you have any idea what that is?
I couldn't tell you exact numbers, but I can tell you that dioceses that have had diaconate for a long time will sometimes, you'll go to a big city parish in, I don't know, Atlanta or Houston or something, and a priest will be celebrating Mass and he'll have two or three or four deacons with him. Now, I don't know that that means the deacons outnumber the priests in a given diocese, though they may at some of these larger parishes. But many dioceses, Western Canada in particular, were not quick to take up the diaconate. And so we're only in our second cohort. So we've got 12 working deacons in our diocese, and that would be, maybe a fifth or a sixth, okay, the number of working priests that we have.
Okay. Okay.
But we're sort of playing catch up right now.
Okay.
So we got three more in formation this time. But yeah, typically in Canada, the priests will outnumber the deacons significantly. If there's a diocese in the States where deacons outnumber the priests, I don't know about it, but it would be somewhere where there has been a long history of diaconate that started right after Vatican II, you know, just over 50 years ago. Priests outnumber deacons by a significant margin.
Do deacons generally serve for life, or do they serve for terms?
Yeah, so you're like our priesthood. If you're ordained, that's a lifelong thing. Okay. Yep. You might retire. You're still a deacon,
right.
But if, you know, right. And often, you know, deacons and priests in our context, you might retire from full-time ministry. But until you're totally incapacitated, we're going to keep asking you for help.
Yeah. That's ministry.
Right? That's ministry. So, you know, like our retired priest will step in and say Mass when a priest is on holiday or when there's a scheduling conflict or, you know, these kinds of things. And same with deacons. I mean, you retire slowly, right? You might step back from your main tasks. In fact, one of the interesting thing with diaconate is a lot of guys who are retiring from their secular work will then put more time into diaconate, right?
Because
they're doing diaconate kind of part-time while they're working, and then they retire and they pour, you know, if they're healthy and whatever, they'll put more, they'll be at the parish and in their ministry, you know, beyond the parish all the time. So it can take that form too.
Yeah. Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, let's start talking about your book. Is this your first book?
It's not. I wrote a little book on purgatory for Catholics and evangelicals.
That sounds interesting.
Yeah, so that could be another episode. That was my master's thesis, and I wrote I co-authored a little book on dating and sexuality. So both of those came out about 10 years ago, and then this just came out in 2019. So this is new, and this was basically my doctoral dissertation. And one of the reasons it reads as a book is because I had published books before I wrote my doctoral dissertation. So I wrote the doctoral dissertation thinking of it more as a book than as a dissertation. So when it came time to publish, there wasn't need to do a lot of the times you write a dissertation, you got to do a lot of work to sort of switch genre from a dissertation to a book. Yeah. And I had kind of written it as a book to start with, which saved me a lot of work.
Well, I was struck now. So let's, you know, a minister in the Christian Reformed Church has had a seminary education. Most of them have had some kinds of, you know, an undergraduate degree, and I'm in my 50s. So I've been reading a variety of kinds of books. I thought your book was very clear. I found your book, I think you're especially in the first, you know, the introduction, I found you deal with a lot of really you deal with a lot of philosophy,
right,
even before the theology. And I thought you laid it out well. Now, I've been playing around in this stuff for a little while because of where the YouTube stuff has taken me.
Okay.
I don't know if you're familiar with John Vervaeke and the video series that he's doing.
No, I've seen his name, but I don't know much about him at all.
Okay, John Vervaeke is a professor of psychology at University of Toronto.
Okay.
And he grew up in a Christian household, gave that up, and has been fairly, I might categorize him as post-Christian. He developed somewhat of a following at his university with a course that he entitled Buddhism and Cognitive Science. He just finished a 50-part video series called Awakening from the Meaning Crisis, where he tries to lay out the history of, there's so many ways to get into this. Let's call it the history of disenchantment.
Okay.
For the history of secularist caused nihilism,
right,
in the Western world. So in some ways tracking with some Charles Taylor, but his goal is to develop communities and practices for post-Christian individuals who are feeling, I would say, dislocated by Western nihilism, to try to address that in his own way pastorally. He walks through the history of religion and theology, sort of winds up with individuals like Paul Tillich, Owen Barfield, trying to work through a bunch of these things. But he forced me to, shake off cobwebs and go back to questions of realists and nominalists and a bunch of the stuff that you'd been developing. I got into YouTube when I made a couple of little commentary videos on the work of Jordan Peterson, especially on what I saw happening in the wake of Jordan Peterson's work, which were a whole bunch of men, usually between the ages of 25 and 45, who had been professed atheists, fans of new atheists such as Sam Harris, and now were becoming very interested in Christianity, some of whom were returning, let's say, to Roman Catholic roots that they had, many who had roots in evangelical traditions becoming very interested in Anglican or even Orthodox churches. I had a conversation with a pastor, a priest, an Orthodox priest in Dallas, Texas, who had spent some time actually in the Presbyterian Church and then the Christian Reformed Church in South Bend, Illinois, had worshiped there when a friend of mine, Len Vanderzee, had been ministering there. And so I'm watching all of this thinking, well, this is really interesting. What's going on? And I'm sort of following the bread trails, I start piecing together a language of sort of neo-sacramentalism, because before the Jordan Peterson stuff, I grew up in my father pastored what I would call first a Christian Reformed Dutch Reformed mission to poor black folks in Paterson, New Jersey. He pastored there from the 60s to the 90s, and so very much in the 60s and 70s became kind of a racial reconciliation church where you had African American folks and some CRC folks who were interested in that type of ministry. That was the context in which I grew up. I went to Calvin College and eventually Calvin Seminary. I spent 7 years overseas in the Dominican Republic, working mostly with poor Haitians. Came back to ministry in North America in Sacramento, California. sort of at the end of the wave of the seeker movement, you know, the right. Bill Hybels, Rick Warren. And so watched that recede, watched the emergent rise, which is sort of split between, I would say, the what became the progressive evangelicals and then the young, restless, and reformed tribe. You know, it's out of this that we find James K. Smith rise right. with his critique of Charles Taylor and his kind of appropriation of Charles Taylor. And I think in terms of my circles, Jamie Smith was my introduction to what was becoming sort of a young Catholic and Reformed movement that I saw happening in the right. Christian Reformed Church. People who went through seminary in the 80s when I was there got very excited about seeker movement, Bill Hybels, A Safe Place to Hear a Dangerous Message, but it basically unreconstructed evangelicalism. And then, so I was taking part in a church planting movement here in Sacramento. The first church out of the gate was sort of a seeker methodology. The second church was sort of a cell church methodology. By the time we hit the 2000s, all of these churches were migrating towards weekly communion, remembering their baptism, far more self-conscious and obvious liturgy, greater right. appreciation for church fathers. And so I'm watching this movement thinking, now this is interesting.
Right. And,
go ahead.
And as a Catholic, growing up in the 90s, we thought the evangelicals were just going to steal all the people because they had the hip music and the preaching and whatever. And this old liturgy stuff was like, we needed to get hip. You know, because liturgy is so, you know, that was 20 to 30 years ago. And now we've grown up to see, like, the evangelicals my age, so I'm 40, grew up in that. And lots of them are looking for liturgy. I talked to a pastor the other day who's, you know, he and his wife had gone to a wedding in an Orthodox church. And they said it was like the most beautiful thing they'd ever seen. Yeah. And 30 years ago, most of the people in their community would said that was full of, you know, sort of traditional nonsense and man-made ritual and all that kind of language. And now it's sort of this, it's beautiful. It's part of our heritage that we've lost. So there's a longing, there's a kind of emptiness, you know, when I go into an evangelical church, but maybe even a Catholic parish that looks a lot like a mall or a coffee shop. There's something, you know, there's a transcendence that I want that's missing, mm-hmm. you know? So even something as simple as a stained glass window is something, you know, that now people are striving for. Whereas, you know, 30 years ago, it was seen as sort of old fashioned and a little, you know, maybe even what's the word I want? Superstitious, you know?
Yes.
So anyway, yeah, I've noticed this basic dynamic and one of the things that has made transubstantiation even, you know, I mean, it sounds shocking, but one of the things that has made transubstantiation more available to non-Catholic Christians is that it's kind of a bulwark against, a totally, secularized space, and it's a way of saying that God is present in our life, in our ritual, in our gathering as church, and it's a very strong affirmation of things that Catholics and Protestants want to be able to say together. And so, I mean, there's all kinds of details that I go through in the book in terms of Christian history and how it was rejected here and there and when that rejection was just and when maybe it was unjust and all that kind of stuff. But when it comes down to brass tacks in terms of this dynamic, you're describing sort of the recent history of, you know, Christianity in North America. It's liturgy in general and then transubstantiation maybe more specifically has become something that evangelicals are like, wait a minute, tell me more, you know?
Yep. So So, you know, all of that, you know, I'm watching this as a pastor, and then Jordan Peterson pops up. And when Jordan Peterson popped up, I had been playing around with YouTube because I realized people don't read a lot of books, you know, people in the pews. And so I'd been playing around with YouTube because I'd been thinking about doing some writing, but I thought, I see pastors write books that nobody reads.
Okay. Yeah.
And so I thought, eh. And Jordan Peterson pops up, and I'd also been wrestling. I've been working through C.S. Lewis's book, Miracles, because that book had fascinated me for a number of years.
Okay. Yeah.
And because I'd been working through the question of what really is happening with our divided world, because on one hand we go to church, and Protestants over the last 100 years have had this major war over what on earth to do with, let's say, Genesis 1 and the cosmology there.
Right.
You know, when you go to seminary, you start learning Hebrew and you begin to play around with Genesis 1 and realize, well, what's a firmament? You know, and you get this image out of Genesis 1 of this earth with a bowl, waters above, waters below. You recognize that some contemporary Bible translations are sort of fudging these terms in a lot of ways to sort of fudge the distance between the picture you might see in Genesis 1 and the picture we're all living with of being on this globe, you know, going around the sun, and you know, all this stuff going on. And I was really thinking about, you know, just the basic preacher task of trying to bridge these two worlds. Well, how do we really think about all of these facts? Okay, so you get Jesus' ascension. He goes up. What's that about? And so you start working through all of these things. And Jordan Peterson comes on the scene, and there's this whoosh. And I want to know what the whoosh is about. And part of it, I could tell, was this distance between these two worlds, these two images of our contemporary image of living on a globe, being hurled through space, this ancient image of, you know, the firmament and the waters above and, you know, the throne room of God and all of this geometry. And so, you know, what's this about? And why would whatever Jordan Peterson telling people to clean their room, why would that send people back to church? That's strange. And so right. I, you know, he did a biblical series. So I start playing around with all of this stuff. And, you know, I begin to recognize that, you know, this, the division of the worlds is a thing that might not be conscious to us, but is deeply beneath the surface.
Right.
And the more I began to wrestle with this, the more I began to see. Well, so then I was watching this debate between Jordan Peterson and Sam Harris. And Jordan Peterson was sort of describing the God that he acts as if he exists. And Sam Harris complaining about all this stuff Sam Harris always complains about. And I realized these two people are talking about two very different things.
Okay.
And I called them God number one and God number two.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I had to, figuring out Sam Harris's God number two was not hard.
Right.
Figuring out what Jordan Peterson was talking about has been significantly more work, but that very quickly put me on the hunt of exactly what you're writing about in this book. Because just today, in fact, there are a couple of YouTube celebrities who grew up evangelical in North Carolina and hit it big and now live in LA as, you know, not just YouTube celebrities, but comedians on a bigger stage. And just over the last few weeks, they have put out some videos and podcasts basically about their deconstruction of their evangelical faith. And for anybody who's been around in church who has watched this happen through countless numbers of people, you know, it's a fairly standard routine that they've gone through. But one of the things that through these last 2 years of working on this stuff, of paying very close attention, listening to people who grew up in the church, left the church, somehow got Jordan Peterson did something to them that nobody seems to know what happened, and we're all sort of guessing at, and of course it's individual and it's different. I came to the real conclusion that God, what we think of as God deep in our guts, has been slowly changing dramatically for a very long time.
Right.
And for many people, reaches sort of a crisis point, and their rejection of a worldview necessitates, you know, huge changes in all sorts of things of their life. And that very deeply gets into the fact that the ancients, when Christianity, so I've been reading a lot of work by Tom, a lot of history by Tom Holland, because I'm going to talk to him in a few weeks. What everyone understood as God has right. deeply changed, and we don't quite know what we mean by the words that we're using anymore.
And
your book, and so this idea of sacramentality of your book, all of this is to me right on the money.
Okay. Well, okay. So let me take a shot at connecting some of the dots from the narrative you just shared to the book. So, because people are wondering, like, okay, doctrine of God, isn't this about, you know, the Eucharist and some crazy medieval, you know, Aristotelian logic scheme to make sense of the Eucharist? And some of the early work I have to do is to investigate how our God language shifted. And there's two shifts. There's a shift after Thomas. So Thomas is kind of the center, Thomas Aquinas. His articulation of transubstantiation is kind of the center of the book. But there's two shifts. There's a shift after Thomas, which between Thomas and the Reformation, which made Thomas's categories very difficult for the reformers to read and understand. But transubstantiation was necessary in the first place because of a shift that happened before Thomas. So in the early church, there seems to be no real debate at all about Christ's presence in the Eucharist. It's you know, John chapter 6, Jesus is really sort of graphic language there. We living after the Reformation, we think, well, how did they not debate about this? Why doesn't this show up in, like, the Council of Ephesus, right? Why, when they were doing the early arguments about the nature of Christ, how come we weren't fighting about the Eucharist? And part of the reason is because everyone sort of culturally was a Platonist. And if you're a Platonist and you say, you know, this is a symbol and God is really present and acting here, the Platonist says, yeah, that's how symbols work. And when that breaks down, you start getting questions in Western Europe, which never really happens, by the way, in Eastern Orthodoxy. It happens in the West,
right. Yep.
Where people start asking, well, this Eucharist thing, is this a symbol or is this real? And the Platonist would say, yes. And the church...
Uh-oh. Zoom here.
Okay.
When, you know... The Platonist would say yes, but the church, and right there you pause, so I don't know if you can go back there.
Yeah, the church in the, you know, 9th through 11th centuries is trying to figure out how to say what something that was easy for a Platonist to say, but it's hard to say in Western Europe in the 9th to 11th century, which is, yes, there's a symbolic element. I mean, any anthropologist looking at Christians celebrating the Eucharist are going to say that the bread represents something and the wine represents something and the eating represents something in the prayer. Like, it's obviously a symbolic nexus, but that doesn't mean it's not God's real presence. And so we need new language to do this in this new cultural context. And transubstantiation emerges to be able to say just that. And if to go into a little detail, the word substance actually becomes sort of the prime category for talking about something which is really, really, really real, maybe more real than the physical, but that is not easily identified with just the physical reality. So today we still live in a similar world where when we say real, we hear physical. And the church wanted to say the physical elements don't change. You can look at them under a microscope. You can put them in a mass spectrometer. You can do all kinds of things, and you will find the chemical reality of bread and wine. And still we are saying that that this is the body and blood of Christ. And so how can you say that? Well, one way you can say that is to say, we actually all recognize in our everyday speech, whether we notice we're doing it or not, that we realize that there's a deeper reality than the physical. So when I recognize that you are Paul, 7 years ago, you know, biologists tell us not one of the cells that is in your body today was in you. Like, we recycle our cells about every 7 years. Certainly the first cell that you were in your mother's womb is long gone. That one probably, you probably weren't even born with that one. That was, you know, but I identify something in you that is a principle of continuity and identity that is deeper than the physical reality, even though it's manifest through the physical reality. When I encounter the physical reality, I encounter things like color and texture and taste and smell and all that kind of stuff. But it's only my intellect that synthesizes all of those data pieces and identifies the deeper reality, which then I can recognize as persisting even though some of those things change, right? I can paint a door a different color and I don't get confused and think it's a different door. I can actually recognize a persisting reality despite a physical change. Now, if we want to go into a little, some changes change the reality. If I burn the door, then I don't have a door anymore. I have something else. So some physical changes can manifest a new reality. Just like you dying, now I don't say that's Paul, I say that's Paul's corpse, and that's a different kind of thing. But anyways, the point is that in our basic experience of reality, we recognize something deeper than the physical, that we intuitively know is more real than the physical. And substance is the language that Thomas Aquinas finds in Aristotle that helps him to communicate this. And well, actually, Thomas isn't the first one who finds it. The language of substance emerges a generation before Thomas that kind of solves a controversy at the time and enters official church teaching. And then Thomas is the one who really articulates it with such clarity that it becomes the sort of standard Catholic reference point for thinking about this. So that's substance, and then from it, transubstantiation emerges as a response to this shift in our attitude philosophically. But then after Thomas, substance itself undergoes a shift, and substance becomes what it is for you and me today. It becomes the physical stuff, the exact thing that Thomas was using it to not be.
Yes, 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 yes.
And when you get to the Reformers 300 years later, transubstantiation starts to look like the opposite of what Thomas meant for it. It becomes a kind of physical or clandestinely physical. Like, you can't really see it, but that's because there's some kind of veil that hides it from us.
Right.
Which is, Thomas insists that is not, like, the Eucharist is not a deception. But in later medieval theologians, it becomes a kind of veil that God is putting over the flesh to keep us from being disgusted by it, all that kind of stuff, which Protestants reject. And I have to say, as a Thomist, Protestants were right to reject that. But what they were rejecting was something which had already transformed and didn't mean what it meant for Thomas. And if we want to now zoom out and go to this question of God, and I'm going to try, this is complex. I do this a lot in the book, but let's try to do it here. One of the things that happens just before Thomas is the Fourth Lateran Council says something like, we can speak about God using analogy. We can't speak about God directly. Our language is unequal to the task of God talk. But we don't despair of knowing true things about God and the mysteries of God. We can actually know true things about God. And when we speak in that way, we can only do it by analogy to things we know in creation. And then here's the key point that Lateran 4 says, but you must recognize whenever you're doing God talk and you're using analogy, that the difference between your articulation and the reality of God is greater than the similarity. So you can actually say true things about God, but you need to recognize the grave limits on what you're doing. And that when you say God is good and you say a watermelon is good, because you have an experience of the goodness of a watermelon, you need to recognize that there's an infinite distance between God's goodness and the watermelon's goodness, even though it is still true in a way to say that God is good. Now, this starts to break down after Thomas with the nominalist school, where they reject analogy or to some degree reject it and say, no, we can say more or less direct things about God because there's a category beyond God against which we can measure both watermelons and God. And we'll call that category being. And once you do that, God is in the system. And this is Sam Harris's God. So the God that's in the system and which can be measured against other things in the system like watermelons is now a God that is in competition with the system. So all kinds of problems that separate Catholics and Protestants that emerge at the Reformation, things like providence and free will.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Providence and free will becomes a problem when God is in the system and one actor's will is measured against the other actor's will in a zero-sum game. So if God's will is done, then mine is not, or vice versa. Thomas Aquinas lives in a totally different world where he asked the question, you know, does the reality of human freedom impede, you know, God's will being done? And he just says so casually, he says, well, no, because God can choose to do his will through human freedom. And he says it as if it's almost self-explanatory.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
We look at it like, well, that's crazy. That doesn't make any sense, you know, because we live in this world where God is in the system and in competition with the other parts of the system, rather than the God that transcends the system and therefore is not in competition with it. So to use an analogy from our own experience, and again, I'm using analogy, so it says something true about God, but its limit is greater than its truth. When I'm a parent and I engage my children at the level of their will, and I butt heads, right? And I say, like, my will versus your will, I'm gonna try push. And I'm going to trump, and I'm the stronger one. So I'm the one who can lock you in your room and whatever, you know, this is not satisfying. Even if I get my way, I do not feel actually free. I don't feel like my freedom has been vindicated because I crushed the weaker party in this conflict. But when, as a parent, I can engage a child in their freedom by reframing the question or doing a kind of a distract and end run around the whatever, and then both of us feel like we were engaged in our freedom and both of our needs can be met, when I'm more free, I can free the weaker party, and when I am less free, I butt heads with the weaker party and then I resort to violence. Now I'm not beating my children, but some kind of coercion, right?
Right, right.
In Thomas Aquinas's world, God is so free that God can engage us at our level of freedom and never have to coerce us. And so providence and free will don't butt heads. And God, now here's what God can do much better than I can do. When the weaker party screws up, God can even work through that. Now, maybe I can do that sometimes. I don't know. But that's the experience I have, is when it all goes well. And so maybe the analogy, part of where it starts to break down, is God is so much freer than I am that even, I don't know, the murder of an innocent man by mob justice under a sort of calculating Roman procurator, even that disaster is something that God's freedom can engage to achieve God's purposes. Right. And so anyway, I mean, that's the God that transubstantiation is trying to witness to. Because one of the questions in sacramental theology is how do we measure the human reality of what we're doing over against the divine reality? So some of the reformers say, well, this is just a community act. we, in our minds, do what Jesus told us to do, and we remember. We do the work of remembering. It's a great irony that the Reformation, which is, you know, God's grace, God's grace, God's grace, ends up with a sacramental theology in at least some cases, not Luther, by the way, and Calvin is more complicated, but the what we might call the left wing, for lack of a better term, I don't know, the Swiss reformers,
right,
end up with a Eucharist where it depends on the humans doing the work, which is very strange.
Yes.
But it only happens because God's work and human work are now butting heads, and they're in a zero-sum game. And transubstantiation is trying to witness to a world where it says God works through the human ritual, the human. We have this beautiful line in our liturgy, fruit of the vine and work of human hands. These are the gifts that we present. They're both gifts of God, the grain and the grapes, but they're also human work. They're a product of human culture. And both the natural gift and the added value of that human culture does in making those into bread and wine are transcended and become God's gift of himself back to us, right? And so we don't have to negate the human to affirm the divine. In the sacraments, we can say God is really the real fundamental actor here, but that is in a way that engages the human and the natural and the cultural, rather than as something that destroys or obviates or whatever the human and the natural and the cultural.
Well, that was, I'm going to use that in a video. That was okay. Tremendous. That was tremendous.
Well, I tried to do the hard work of the first chapter in, you know, I don't know how long.
Oh, it was tremendous. You did it very well. A couple of things stand out right away in two things. I'll say the first one, then I'll land on the second one. The first one, in watching people, walk away from Christianity in the West, watching the post-Christian journey, which I see often close up, it's interesting that they go back to a sort of pantheism, which is what C.S. Lewis calls, you know, basic human religion. That's sort of the default location of our imagination. Now, it's interesting that many of them don't sort of try to maintain what I think is a very difficult position to maintain, which is that of an atheist like Sam Harris. I think that's actually a very difficult place to stay, that we people tend to default back to a sort of paganism, where they do so to naturally re-enchant the world. When their car breaks down, they talk to it. When circumstances in their life are frustrating, they appeal to the universe. They don't want to say God because that's too churchy. They appeal to the universe. But it's interesting that they once again default to a situation where universe is acting through the fruit of the vine and acting through the hands of their enemies or friends.
Right.
And so that's the first point, but it gets to the second point, which is the human nature dichotomy. And I love, how you use that phrase out of the liturgy, because what someone would say would be, there's a fundamental difference between the fruit of the vine, because that happens, for lack of a better word, automatically without any will involved, and the work of human hands, which we, all of our language separates this out. We would say the fruit of the vine is a natural process. And in terms of all of our language, even our language about climate change, we would say, there's natural climate change, and mentally we take human beings out of the picture.
Right.
And then we say there's, man-made, we're allowed to use man in a term like that. Man, because we can blame men for this. There's man-made climate change.
Right.
And so, right, and of course, we're looking at this dichotomy that arises and becomes very instrumental in the scientific revolution, especially in deism. I mean, I think deism has many ways this stuff baked in.
right. Yeah, and a couple things. I mean, one is, you know, as much as we worry about the new atheists, when you go, you know, for Thanksgiving dinner with your family, you're going to have a lot more people who think they talk to their cat than you're going to have a rigorous new atheist, you know.
Who think their tech cat talks back to them.
Right. I think there's, right, humans, even if you want to be a really rigorous atheist, you're going to find transcendence in something. Like, I don't care what, whether it's talking cats or violent political ideologies. I mean, I think one of the things really driving our increasingly polarized political rhetoric is that people are finding their transcendence in political movements.
Yes.
And so you might say you're an atheist, but you are going to have some value that you consider worthy of great sacrifice. And I mean, I don't think we have a very functional operative definition of religion. You know, we have this world religions definition that means if you can check one of these boxes, Buddhism, Hinduism, Judaism, Islam, Christianity, then you're religious. And then we say, well, there's people who don't check any of those, but they still like spiritual things. So they're spiritual, but not religious. This is all very vague. I think if you want to get down to brass tacks, your religion is what you will sacrifice anything else for. And so you will find transcendence in, you might find it in the Super Bowl, you might find it in a Trump rally, you might find it in a women's march. You'll find it, you know, gay pride parade is drenched with transcendent claims. This is what humans do. We are believing and worshiping creatures, right? And so, do you know the novelist David Foster Wallace?
Yeah.
He's got this great quote from this address he gave to Kenyon College where he says everybody worships. And he says most of the things you worship will eat you alive.
Yep.
If you don't have a sense of an actual transcendent God. And so here's where we get back to the non-competitive God that is not in the system. Anything in the system will demand destructive sacrifices because it's in competition with everything else. But an actually transcendent God can ask for sacrifices that put you in harmony with the rest of the system, right? And so when we see the development of sacrificial language in the Old Testament, right? If you think of Abraham and Isaac, and the story there of the move from human sacrifice to animal sacrifice, what you're seeing is a less violent, less sort of zero-sum game, because this impulse is now being passed off. But then Yahweh starts saying, even this animal sacrifice is open to wild misinterpretation. And if you think you can use this to manipulate me, the real, actual, and transcendent God, maker of all things, you've got it upside down. And so sacrifice then migrates to becoming a more ethical thing. What do I demand from you? But you know, the circumcised heart, all this kind of stuff. And then in the cross, it becomes self-sacrifice, even for the sake of your enemy. And when that is the sort of end game of the human desire for transcendence, which will demand some sacrifice, it is only the transcendent God that is not in competition, that doesn't need you in your sacrifices, that can actually ask for a sacrifice that puts you in a peaceful order with creation and not in the power game of subverting this or that group. But when we get to the other forms of transcendence, like the right, our current political climate, I think we have reverted. We might say that this is all very secular. I think we've reverted to sacrificial power games, which is the whole Old Testament is a polemic against this move. So this goes to an element of the Eucharist as sacrifice, which isn't what the book is about. But the Eucharist is the peaceful sacrifice,
right?
It is the joint, but it's a recognition that we can never make that peaceful sacrifice because of our sinfulness. All of our sacrifices, however well-intentioned, and the reformers had this dead right. I mean, Luther was completely clear-sighted on the ambiguity of his own motivations when approaching God. When we approach the Eucharist, our motives will always be mixed. So calling it a sacrifice says, despite your imperfection, you can participate in this peaceful sacrifice, which was made for you because you can't do it.
Right.
So, yeah.
Well, and that's, and you're right. And that then becomes in my tradition, in the Reformed tradition, that then becomes sort of the centerpiece. But I love how you laid out, because once, when I started making YouTube videos and I mentioned, well, I'm a minister in a Calvinist denomination, it's like, whoosh, Calvinists. And I think you languaged this. I think you languaged this very, very well. Now, I love how you laid out, because this, God is not in the system. And this gets laid out around this word being.
Okay.
And another thing that's been interesting to me is the rise of simulation theories out in the world. And I think this also is a manifestation of, people know things in their guts that don't necessarily travel up to their, out of their mouths through their brains. And they act them out in their lives. But the question of, how to talk about God in terms of being a being, God is not a being. And I think, again, in your book, you laid that out, and that then gets into this question of,
finding things. There's so much good stuff in your book. But laying out where you talked about, well, here it is, this, the omnipresence. And this is a quote from, let me back up a little bit. In kind of typical formation as a youth in the Dutch Reformed tradition, there's a lot of anti-Catholicism that held sway really until sort of the 80s.
Okay.
And so transubstantiation was taught to me as this, I read it in your book and it's like, oh yeah, I totally got propagandized against the Roman Catholics in terms of what transubstantiation was. And I made an ungenerous comment in one of my videos, and a bunch of my Catholic listeners were all over me and said, watch this video by Bishop Behrens about the Eucharist. And I watched that video and I listened to that video and I thought, this doesn't sound a lot different from what, some different words, but this doesn't sound a lot different from what I believe the Lord's Supper is. And that, of course, really set me up for your book. But point from this quote from Aquinas: God is no such extended, long, broad, thick, high, deep being. He is a supernatural, inscrutable being. But I don't think supernatural means today what it meant for him either.
He's trying to tell you what supernatural means.
Right.
Yeah.
He is a supernatural, inscrutable being who exists at the same time in every little seed, whole and entire, and yet also in all and above all and outside all created things. Nothing is so small, but God is still smaller. Nothing is so large, but God is still larger. Nothing is so short, but God is still shorter. Nothing is so long, but God is still longer. Nothing is so narrow, but God is still narrower, and so on. He is inexpressible.
Can you tell me what page you're on?
I'm at page 169.
So I'm thinking this is not Thomas. This is Luther.
Really?
Yeah. This is Luther, and so okay. If you look, so right above, I have a short quote from Thomas that says, "God is in all things and innermostly." And then I say, compare this with Luther, who wrote, and then it's the thing that you just said. Luther is trying in a new idiom to say things that Thomas would say in a much more philosophical register, that Luther's heritage has lost for him. But Luther intuits it, and Luther says it in very concrete, earthy kinds of ways, which is how Luther talks. And a lot of the work I do in the book is to say, look, this stuff that Thomas is saying in a philosophical register, once Luther's tradition has dispensed with that register, he still wants to say the kinds of things Thomas was trying to say, but he has to say them in a different way. So a lot of the book is a translation. You know, it's like compare what Luther says and what Thomas says, and taking into account their own philosophical traditions, and in the case of Luther, some of what I consider to be the gaps in the nominalist philosophical tradition, or the errors. Can we see in them a common intention to say something, in this case, about God? But then once we've said what God is, about how God acts in the world, and particularly in the sacraments. And so I try to show, first with Luther. So for those who, so if you look at the table of contents, this might be helpful for the listener. After the introductory chapter, there's a chapter on Thomas, then there's a chapter on Luther, then there's a chapter on Calvin.
Yep.
And after I lay out why the medieval tradition found transubstantiation helpful and how Thomas articulated it, I go to the Reformation and I say, transubstantiation is no longer available as the category it was for Thomas because of the changes in the philosophical environment. Luther and Calvin both want to say that Christ is really present in the Eucharist, but they need new tools for doing it. And on the surface level, they look like they're contradicting the Catholic tradition on transubstantiation. But if you dig, and one of the key features which you're highlighting here is, first, let's think about who God is and God's relationship with creation, which we're going to say in different ways because of our different philosophical traditions. We're going to end up saying remarkably similar things. And one of the things that really struck me, so I'll tell the reverse story of you as a Calvinist hearing about Catholics. If a Catholic says something that sounds a little too symbolical about the Eucharist, the first accusation is that's Calvinism. and I thought, yeah, that's terrible. I don't want to be a Calvinist. And when you start reading the literature around this, there's this pattern which I note at the very beginning of the chapter on Calvin, which is like, I pull out like a dozen examples of scholars, Catholic, Reformed, and Lutheran scholars, and I think there's a Baptist scholar in there and an Anglican, like scholars from across the spectrum, who when they read Thomas and Calvin on the Eucharist say, this looks remarkably similar. And so there's trouble with Calvin because Calvin's writing in a polemical context where sometimes he's writing against a certain set of Lutherans who have a very literalistic reading, and sometimes he's writing against the Swiss, which have this much more symbolic reading. So it's easy to find quotes from Calvin to prove anything you want because of the different sort of fronts he's fighting on. But I think a holistic read of Calvin ends up landing him remarkably close to Thomas. And this is shocking to people. But I think once you read the stuff, it's basically undeniable. And I wonder, like, as a Christian Reformed pastor, you watch Bishop Barron, you said, well, that doesn't sound so bad.
No, I'm thinking, this is not what I expected.
Right.
And, but you know, even this, you know, my misreading of your quote here, I mean, because if you read what Luther has to say about Aquinas, I mean, right. Thomas Aquinas was fighting words to Luther. And essentially what you're saying is, Well, that's because Luther, by virtue of the history that happened between Aquinas and Luther and where Luther is situated, that's because Luther wasn't really understanding Aquinas.
Right, right. He wasn't able to read him on his own terms.
Yeah.
The categories had shifted to such a degree, and Luther comes out of a tradition that has explicitly rejected Thomas on several points.
Yes.
Luther quotes the learned Cardinal of Cambrai, Pierre Dailly, who was a student of Ockham, saying consubstantiation would be more philosophically coherent than transubstantiation. And in the book, I go through a careful analysis of why in the 12th century, consubstantiation was seen to be philosophically untenable. And by the 16th century, it looked more tenable than transubstantiation. And it's because the categories had shifted. And I don't know, I don't have it all right at the front of my mind right now. So you might have to read the book to see that. But basically, I try to show that they're trying to say the same thing, but within their different philosophical categories, their answers look like opposites, but they're not. And even Joseph Ratzinger, so Pope Benedict the 16th, writes an article that I quote extensively in the book in like 1968 or something, where he says that if you understand what Luther's trying to say with consubstantiation, it's not actually an opposite of transubstantiation. It's trying to say the same thing with a different set of categories. Here's even though I don't have it all at the front of my head, here's the basics. Luther wants to affirm the persistence of the bread and wine in some real way, that they're not just a veil or a disguise. Well, Thomas insists that the bread and wine are not a veil or a disguise. He says the accidents of the bread and wine remain. And we tend to think, well, that doesn't mean very much. But the accidents are actually what is required for them to properly signify what they're supposed to signify. Hmm. Accidents aren't some metaphysical nothing. Accidents are, when Thomas is asked, you know, is there a deception here if we don't see the substance? He says, no, you see the accidents and they're really there. So you're not deceived. So if you understand substance and accidents the way Thomas understands them, he's not saying the bread and the wine have like evaporated or been annihilated. He explicitly rejects annihilation, which is one of the possible theories that's floated at the time. The accidents are really there and they have an essential role in the sacrament, which is a lot of what Luther is trying to say when he prefers something that looks like consubstantiation, is that the physical reality of the thing is not obliterated, annihilated, etc. But by the time you get to Luther, the annihilation theory has become part and parcel with transubstantiation. Hmm. And so it's not what Thomas meant by transubstantiation. So hopefully I got close to that. I didn't have it right at the front of my head, but it seemed to come to me as I spoke. No, the basic point is Luther and Calvin are all trying to say that Christ is really present in the Eucharist. And Thomas is trying to say Christ is really present in the Eucharist, and they're using different conceptual categories to do it. But if their intention is basically the same, we shouldn't be surprised if we go digging. And by the way, their deepest roots, even if their philosophical recent roots are off, their deepest roots are Scripture and Augustine.
Yeah.
We shouldn't be surprised that they actually end up saying things that are remarkably the same. And so I was even shocked as I did the research and the writing at how strong I could make my conclusion. Like at first I thought, oh, I'd make some careful distinctions that would show it wasn't as bad as we all thought. And by the end of the book, I make some pretty bold claims that I didn't expect to make when I started writing it.
Yeah.
But I felt perfectly justified. And I haven't got pushback on them yet. All the, you know, from Catholics and Protestants reading it.
Yeah.
In the back of the book, I've got two Protestant and two Catholic endorsements.
Yeah.
Nobody has said, oh, that's not fair. You're papering over this or you're ignoring that. A Christian Reformed pastor reads it and says, hey, this sounds right.
I'm not the only one. I've been shopping your book around and I'm going to do more, obviously, with this video.
Okay.
I found your book tremendously compelling, tremendously helpful. And, you know, I think some of the people listening to this video will imagine that we're talking something small and narrow, like theological distinctions behind practices of separated you know, ecclesiastical concerns. But I think actually your book points to some tremendously helpful ideas that are vital for doing missionary work in the West today.
Mm.
Because, and this again is where, I mean, because I got into this via, you know, this crazy Canadian psychologist who, so I have my brother-in-law is from Manitoba. And when I listened to Jordan Peterson talk, he's from, you know, Northern Alberta.
Right.
And I listened to him talk, I thought, it sounds like my brother-in-law, you know,
right.
You Northern Canadians, you don't like getting pushed. You know, when you get pushed, you push back. And I, you know, Jordan Peterson's there. Well, you know, I'm not going to say it. And if they arrest me, I'm not going to eat. And you know, I'm thinking, it's kind of like my brother-in-law. But there's, you know, so this guy complaining over pronouns, you know, suddenly gets visibility that he had some visibility before, but suddenly a lot of visibility. And the whole political thing to me was kind of, okay, that's going on. That sort of gave him his lift. But the issues that he's beginning to manifest and point out, These are vitally important for why people are rejecting, and I think I love the way you put it, rejecting a God that's in the system, because a lot of the, you know, what one question that has interested me for a while and has interested a lot of Protestants is the genesis of the problem of evil.
Okay.
I would, you know, in terms of how you lay things out here, it's, whereas you can certainly see certain forms of what we look at as the problem of evil in the book of Job. So a lot of these questions are very ancient, but many, many people have noted Tim Keller, for example, in his book on suffering and evil, many people have noted that the problem of evil with its contemporary power really take shape in the early modern period. For example, like with the earthquake and fire and flood of Lisbon.
Okay.
That's something that comes up. And because very quickly, well, you know, again, for thousands of years, people would be asking, how can God allow this? You know, the rise of Islam, let's say, in the East, and how it, you know, destroys the Eastern Church in many ways and destroys the Eastern Empire and threatens, you know, the West. Well, I've been reading Tom Holland's book about the rise of Islam, and very clearly the success on the battlefield is the witness of the will of God for the world. And that's simply how everyone in that world would understand it. Because God is made manifest through the events of history. Now, obviously, there are plenty of theological conversations about that, because you know everybody has to deal with these issues. But the questions of, okay, what exactly are we talking about when we use this word God, and how does that relate to history?
So can I take a crack at something here?
Please, go right ahead.
Yeah.
I talk lots, so I wanted to hear you.
So I haven't thought about the problem of evil with respect to this question of God outside the system. So this, I'm riffing. But something strikes me as really interesting. If we read the Old Testament, we can see that in the early layers, the Hebrews have a theology that is quite common in the ancient world, which is if my God beats your God, my God is stronger than your God.
Right, right.
And it's the Babylonian captivity that makes that heuristic for thinking about God impossible.
Right.
And it's also, most biblical scholars would say, this is when biblical monotheism is most carefully articulated. This is when the final versions of the Genesis, first, you know, 1 and 2 Genesis, but especially Genesis 1, are put down. And we get a picture of one God. And now the other gods, they're either not real at all, or they're demons, but they're not They're not gods in competition with God. And this is the way the Jews are not destroyed by the Babylonian captivity. Because the obvious theological answer in the ancient Near East is Marduk is stronger than Yahweh. And therefore, your God, your temple is destroyed. Your God can't defend you. You know, worship Marduk. That would be the logical thing to do. And the Jews say, actually, Marduk is not real. Yahweh is, in fact, punishing us. He didn't lose this fight. And he's still in control. And he's actually still with us. You have here historically a unique chosen people finding their way into getting God out of the system. And so then historical events, for good or ill, are the manifestation of that God's will. Now, that doesn't mean that evil isn't evil, but it introduces a philosophical problem, right? You have this good God who wants your good. I mean, this is the Jewish God. God is doing this for your good. Even the ill that befalls you is in some way for your good. And we see in the book of Job, it's not always easy to tell how that ill is for your good. There are times, right? I can go to the gym and not like exerting myself, and I can see how that is for my good. But if my kid dies of leukemia, that's a lot trickier, right? And so one of the answers in Job is, you do not have the perspective from which to see whether or not this is for your good.
Right.
And so if you live in that world, you can still say something like the rise of Islam, which looks catastrophic for the Eastern Church. God can still work through that. And the crucifixion is, again, the paradigmatic example of this great evil, which befalls not you, but me, actually, which I take on your behalf. Somehow can your good can be worked through it. And that can happen if God is outside the system and not sort of totally compromised by the engagement and the loss found in the system. If you have then a God that's back, and I'm just guessing, God that starts getting back into the system by the early modern period, and God is one being among many, and God's intentions are in competition with these other intentions, et cetera, et cetera. If God does not work through good and ill, but God is confronted with ill as an enemy that is in some ways on equal footing, and God doesn't defeat it, then what kind of God have you got?
Right.
Right. So I can see why the problem of evil becomes a specific kind of thing. It's not that it was never a problem,
right?
Or you wouldn't write the book of Job.
Right.
But it's a new kind of problem if God is back in the system.
Right.
Because then God is in a zero-sum game with the evil in the world instead of transcending it and being able to do good even through the evil.
Right. And then he needs our help, maybe. You know,
right?
if you watch a movie like Avatar, which fascinates me. So Avatar is your classic post-Christian, neo-pantheist movie where, you know, these colonialists who are trying to mine unobtainium from, you know, this wonderful idyllic planet where, you know, it's a pantheistic world, and then you have your great battle scene, and then the God starts fighting for us, and it's like, you know, you just gave away your pantheism, because you can't have these distinctions. Hang on a second. There are two books I carry around with me right now. I don't like carrying around books because I'm always reading way too many at once, and they're heavy and they fill my bag. Yours has been in my bag. I've been carrying your book around, which says how much I really value you, book. And let me show you the other book.
Okay, now, this is curious. Who will I be associated with on the internet for posterity?
Well, I don't know. Well, maybe in the future. Do you recognize this book?
No, I don't. But it strikes me as something that's probably in the background of every intro Old Testament, whatever stuff I've been doing. Like it, even the title looks like.
This is a book by Ezekiel Kaufman, translated and abridged by Moshe Greenberg. I first got acquainted with Ezekiel Kaufman and this idea from Christine Hayes, who in her Introduction to Old Testament course on YouTube, I'll put the link in the notes here so you can find it. I've talked about it a lot in my videos. Talks about Ezekiel Kaufman, who basically said, you know, this whole kind of evolutionary approach to monotheism, you don't find the roots of that in the Old Testament. The Old Testament, he's a Jewish scholar, so he's not a Christian. The Old Testament, if that evolutionary approach to monotheism were true, the Old Testament would look very different.
Okay.
And you can find traces of henotheism and basically worship of one God as opposed to other gods. I mean, the Old Testament is a complex document. But he basically says, you know, there are fundamentally two perspectives on the world. One perspective is what he calls the metadivine realm, where you have an impersonal universe, and out of this universe emerges the gods, you know, let's say Greek, you know, out of this universe emerges the gods who become actors, and the gods then make people down. You have this huge chain of being, and history is basically the struggle of these beings within this impersonal metadivine realm that gives rules and context to everything that's going on.
Okay.
And once you begin to understand that, you can look at modern materialism, you can look at ancient paganism. They all have a degree of commonality in that the universe is fundamentally impersonal, and you know, there's all these willful agents vying for power and to get what they want.
Right.
On the other hand, you have God. And when I've been poking around in this stuff, at the same time I start reading your book, and it's
that's interesting.
Oh, wow. That and the conception of God. But, you know, the other thing I underlined on this same page, on page 169, way down at the bottom, in this affirmation, it is not as different as you might at first glance appear from Luther's view, as described, for instance, by David Steinmetz. God is near, that is his immanence. God's presence is inaccessible apart from his word and sacrament, that is his transcendence. Now, once Kaufman's perspective on human thought and history has sufficiently colonized to the degree that suddenly when I'm looking around, I'm seeing this distinction between a metadivine realm out of which emerges all sorts of things, and you know, let's use the term naturally. There's no intention in it. It's very Darwinian. I mean, that's essentially the move that Darwin makes. Jordan Peterson promoted a book called The Metaphysical Club, and which is basically the history of the rise of pragmatism in American philosophy. And that book makes very clearly something that I hadn't really seen before, that, you know, before Darwin, there were plenty of people talking evolutionary theories. The thing that Darwin really, really turned the page on is that there is no purpose to this. There is no, you know, there is no will in this. And
right.
So now suddenly you begin to say, okay, well, we're back to the metadivine realm. We're back fundamentally to the Greeks, to all of this stuff. And really the thing that the Hebrews do, and it's, again, I also came across, you know, these transitions. I was doing a long study through the book of Ezekiel and just continually being amazed at this prophet who, you know, some thinks might have been schizophrenic, having these wild dreams and doing these wild enactments in captivity in Babylon, to have the chutzpah to have God show up on his royal throne over Babylon and say, oh, by the way, I can show up here too, and it ain't nothing to me, and so I'll use the Babylonians, and I'm still accomplishing my will, even as they destroy my temple, which y'all have destroyed anyway by violating the covenant, you know, so on and so forth. And so I begin to see, you know, at Christianity, you know, very clearly the faithful heir of the Hebrew scriptures in terms of the conceptualization of not an impersonal realm, which is sort of manifesting things, and then all these agents vying for power within it, which is basically polytheism, but this other vision of, well, God is not a part of the system. God is, you know, God is being, but then how does that then translate into this crazy world of Babylonians and burned temples and Job suffering, and then obviously climaxing on someone who, you know, someone who basically is upsets his own people because he's not sufficiently anti-Roman and is rather incidental to the Romans, like, yeah, we can kill him. That's not a big, lots of people. And, you know, I'm you know, basically what I've been doing over the last couple of years is trying to piece these things together. And I'm finding your book a really helpful missiological prolegomena in terms of maybe
I'd like to put that on the cover. Yeah.
Maybe some ways that Christian preachers need to talk and reconceptualize what on earth we're talking about with sacrament. You know, the other day, I usually come up with ideas when I'm making my videos, not before them. But, you know, I figured out that in a weird way, you know, because what is a dollar? A dollar is a, you know, a dollar is not a physical thing.
Right. It's an agreed upon symbol set.
That's right. This is a sacrament right here.
Oh, well, okay. So this is interesting. It's an agreed upon symbol set that we can all use, you know, very handily, and it's very practical and whatever else. But if it represents the highest good for which you will sacrifice the other things, the other goods, then it's a sacrament, right?
That's right.
Yeah, yeah. I wanted to jump in on a couple things that you.
Yeah, go ahead.
You're the one world that's not the God world, right?
The meta-divine realm.
The meta-divine realm. So one of the key distinctions I see between those two realms that you articulated is fate and freedom.
Yes.
So yes, you have these agents that are striving with each other, but of course the stories that we tell in that realm are these terrible tragedies where, you know, you're gonna kill your father and sleep with your mom. And then you do everything you can to avoid killing your father and sleeping with your mom. And it's precisely the avoidance techniques that lead you to kill your father and sleep with your mom.
Yes.
History is like, there actually isn't history.
Right.
History is a category, doesn't exist in that. There is fate.
Yes.
Often this will be in a cyclical kind of realm. Everything that has happened, that is happening, has happened, will happen again. And it's only the transcendent God that Ezekiel is pointing to in the throne above Babylon that makes both and simultaneously human history and human freedom possible, and even meaningful claims. And one of the things that happens, I'm utterly convinced by the science that evolution explains, you know, human biology. Well, not just human, but biology on the planet Earth today, and if it's anywhere else in the universe. But one of the things that follows from not a scientifically circumspect theory of evolution, but from a kind of Darwinistic ideology, is that freedom is an illusion, mm-hmm. Right? You get back into this sense that if the natural, you know, world is what it is and does what it does, and there is nothing to transcend it, then freedom can only be an illusion. And so then we're in a really awkward spot, because then I think C.S. Lewis points out, well, if your freedom is an illusion, then you were fated to think that your freedom was an illusion, and then you're really stuck, right? What do you, like, so you actually can't know, at that point, you can't know if it was an illusion or not, because you were just fated into it, right? it's a really unsatisfying sort of worldview, because it's self-refuting in these awkward kinds of ways. And we all experience our freedom in some way or other, and we try to make sense of it. But within those ancient categories, which are often returning in new guises, and this happens over and over again, that the ancient categories that were transcended by Judaism and Christianity, as we see the eclipse of Judaism and Christianity and the Judeo-Christian worldview, these things will reappear, whether that's transcendent political claims, right? I mean, worship the god or emperor. I don't know if you've noticed any rhetoric that looks a little like that.
I don't know. I'm thinking that when he leaves residence in Washington, D.C., he might move to Utah, because Utah just decriminalized polygamy. And I would think, you know, when I look at our current resident of the White House, you know, people debate him, but I think we just have sort of an emperor, because he kind of does what an emperor, if you read history, it's like, you know, he's kind of hemmed in by all of our culture and laws and everything. But if he had his way, he'd have a harem, he'd have a bodyguard. It's all there.
Right. So, I mean, we can look at, you know, individual examples, of course, but, you know, but I think in general, our political rhetoric has taken on elements of the transcendent that were strongly critiqued by, for example, the early Christians in Rome. Yeah. But as the Christian worldview fades, we become less able to see the distinctions between, say, politics and religion that Christianity actually introduced into the world. Yeah. Judaism first, let's be honest. Judaism, and then following that, Christianity to the wider world. But it's been pretty common for human history to not distinguish between politics and religion. And right now we say we distinguish between them, but that's only because we have a completely inadequate definition of religion. Right. That we can actually say religion is this privatized thing that you do with your friends and family on Sundays, and politics is where the real world happens. As soon as you've said that, all you've said is, politics is religion, and this other thing is a hobby. Right. And that's the appropriate categories for talking about those things, right? Yeah. But anyways, within those two, right, it's the Judeo-Christian worldview that you're highlighting from this book, this other book that you've been reading, that makes possible things like the distinction between politics and religion, that makes possible the idea of human history and human freedom, that makes possible things like religious tolerance. We're told that and there are some Christians who sound like theocrats, but really the real religious intolerance is the sacralizing of the political.
Yes.
We picked on, you know, the president, but this is
both sides.
this is happening on both extremes. There's a sacralizing of the political commitments that reduce what we typically call religion to a hobby. And this is where the real sacrifices are demanded. And this is where we brook no opposition.
Yes.
The enemy must be destroyed.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Yeah. And not just silenced, but, you know, eradicated, literally, eliminated, and all of that language then comes. No, that's right. I agree with what you've just said. Have you heard, there's an English writer named Tom Holland. Have you ever heard of him?
I haven't.
Okay, here's another, giving you another book recommendation. Tom Holland is if you look on my channel, you'll see some things from him. He's I first came across his book, Rubicon. He's an English writer who started writing about the classical period and loved sort of the classical stories of, you know, crossing the Rubicon, the Roman emperors. He had a book, Persian Fire, where he deals with, you know, the Greco-Persian War. And he wrote a book on Islam, which, you know, he basically late antiquity. He had some suspicions about the little bit of the propagandist tale of the rise of Islam. And so he did, you know, he's a historian, and he writes history in a very popular way, but he's a historian. And he got into a lot of trouble with that book about Islam because he basically was saying that the Islamic origin tale that is told by what we currently look at as the religion of Islam really doesn't, if you apply what's been rigorously applied to Christianity over the last couple of hundred years to Islam, there's some interesting things arise and some skepticism about that. Well, obviously he got a lot of pushback from the Islamic world on that. And so someone says to him, you know, why don't you do it to your own religion? He's kind of, he'd been raised, nominal Anglican in a bit. He's like, well, I don't have a religion. So then he decides, and you can see this, the roots of it in his book on Islam. He starts doing this to Christianity, and his latest book is entitled Dominion. And I think you're exactly right in that we have now gotten to the point where we can begin to see Christianity's influence again because we're beginning to see its recession.
Right.
And that book Dominion, so for him, he basically is telling people, essentially what René Girard had been saying too, the only language you have to critique Christianity is Christian language. Right. And whereas you're denying God vigorously all over here, you're promoting a morality that essentially you've simply inherited by Christianity and is right. completely unthinkable from the pagan world.
Right.
Because
right.
their morality was fundamentally different and Christianity radically reoriented the world.
Right.
But you can't see it. And you imagine that somehow, because you say God does not exist, that your system is in some clean room by which it's been untouched by, by Christianity. So that's just preposterous. So I think it would be a very interesting book for, I try to, wonky books like this I got a pretty smart audience, but a book like Dominion can be popularly enjoyed by people and they can begin to understand his point. So,
right. I love René Girard, and he would say that basic insight he had was actually Nietzsche had it first.
Yes.
Nietzsche is actually the honest atheist who sees the Christian genealogy of the morals of the West, and understands that when Christianity goes, so do the morals. He thinks that's a good thing. I mean, he endorses that move. So Christians aren't going to agree with him there, and neither will Girard, but Nietzsche actually saw that dynamic with remarkable sort of prescience, and it feels almost silly to watch, people who might consider themselves to be Nietzsche's heirs in the atheist, limelight, who are painfully naive on this point. And want to live on the sort of coattails of Christian morality, while undermining the cultural possibilities for those. And so then as the Christian worldview becomes less obvious, I think you're right. David Foster Wallace tells this joke in the thing I mentioned about the two young fish swimming along, right? And the old fish says, "How's the water, boys?" And when he's out of earshot, one says to the other, "What the hell's water?" Once the Christian water is drained out of the pool, we can actually see what was floating in it, right?
Yeah.
But right now, I mean, we're getting, it's becoming more clear. Yes. And some voices are helping us see that. I think René Girard is an incredible voice for helping us see that.
Yep.
I'm really grateful, actually, that you can see in my book, which seems to be about a very narrow, specific kind of topic, a series of connections to these bigger questions about transcendence, what we mean by God, the history of the West, freedom, fate. I mean, it seems to me that you get it. You've read the book and you've understood the sort of streams that are feeding into it and the deeper intention behind it. So there is one particular question which for me is very important for Catholics and Protestants to understand one another clearly on this, because one of my great passions is Christian unity. And I have a kind of anxiety when I watch Christians disagree with each other when they actually don't understand what the other Christian believes. Like, that drives me batty. And so a really important part of my book is, let's listen to each other, because we don't disagree nearly as much as we've been told.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the story you've shared. I'm not going to say we don't disagree at all. I do say in the end, there are disagreements, and I propose a way forward that make some bold claims. I'm not whitewashing things or whatever, but I want to make sure that we actually understand what the other person is claiming. So I'm doing that work on a very specific question that's important to Christians, right? The Lord's Supper, the Eucharist. But also, I think it does have this broader application. I like to use it, missiological prolegomena.
Yeah.
If we do not understand the worldview in which we are operating and what the Christian alternative to that worldview is, we're doing worse than treading water. Yeah. You know, it's sort of slowly coming up over our eyes, right? And if we can get a glimpse of the Christian worldview through this particular refraction of it, but there's dozens of other ways we could do it, right? Providence and free will, fate and history, we could use all these lenses to get there. If we can get a picture of the Christian view of reality and see how that is a much more satisfying and a much more human picture than what is on offer in a post-Christian world, then I think we're well equipped to speak into the longings of our contemporary culture, which, you know, you highlighted the sort of neo-sacramentalism. If Jordan, think what you will about Jordan Peterson's argument on this or that point, if he's done anything, he's highlighted for us the vacuum, the spiritual vacuum that young men, but not only young men, but particularly young men, are experiencing in contemporary culture. They're famished for something. And I think the Christian worldview, which is largely shared by Catholics and Protestants, and which is to a large degree shared by our Jewish brothers and sisters, offers us something really satisfying and compelling. And so I'm just delighted that when you read a book about a very narrow topic like transubstantiation, you could see this sort of spider web that grows out from that and all the different attachment points it has to all these other questions.
I could probably, if this book had come away my way 3 or 4 years ago, I wouldn't have seen it.
Mm.
Because I would have understood the book in the light of, well, you know, Roman Catholic Protestant history and tradition. And I probably would have read the book and thought, wow, that's really cool. But the first chapter.
I'll take that. That's not bad.
Yeah, but, that's not bad. And I think as I try and get a bunch of my colleagues to read it, that's how they will read it. But the introduction to the book, the question of what on earth? So these two guys, you know, I'll see if I can listen to the rest of their, basically their deconstruction, deconversion stories, where these guys grew up deeply evangelical and now consider themselves maybe hopeful agnostics. When I listen to all of the issues that they bump into that contributed to their deconstruction, I think it has everything to do with the metadivine realm and theism are always in tension. And so what is happening is that I have these God number one and God number two. So Christianity is fully, you know, if I'd reread that quote from Luther, a lot of pantheists would get all excited because, well, that sounds like pantheism. But I was like, oh no, that's not mere pantheism. Right. That is because pantheism, this is fully colonized. This is not the metadivine realm,
right?
Where everything is just sort of one. And that's right. Because if you read the classics, you know, they're always resisting. The inevitability is that fate will somehow finally have its way, and you can't you can't resist the rules of the meta-divine realm, just like materialists can't resist the rules of physics.
Right. Even Zeus can't escape the fates.
That's right. Even Zeus. Mm-hmm. So what's happening now is that in this play between God number one, which is sort of your immanent God, and God number two, which is your transcendent God, as in the, oh gosh, we can talk forever. I know I got to let you go. What happened in Darwin and for a long time before that in Christianity, God number one sort of shrank from the Christian imagination, and evangelical sort of expanded God number two in order to try to compensate. But again, God was now in the system, and that sets up all of the wrong moral intuitions for people. And then they eventually just say, I can't take this anymore. And so then they go through another pattern, and this happens through various lifetimes for people, you know, their parents and so on and so forth, right. Generations. But, and then they kind of reset to a paganism, only to realize that, gosh, all of the good things that they have gained have been through this other tradition, which continues to colonize it. So anyway, that's
right.
Hours of video talking about this, but I know I gotta let you go.
And false dichotomies, right? I mean, this God number two gets expanded, and then you get a series of false dichotomies, which lead to this cognitive dissonance, which leads to people eventually building up, in some cases, what I would say, the courage to actually leave the church.
That's right.
Right? And what? Once someone has gone through the emotional work of that, that's really tough to get back.
Yeah.
Because it's not just intellectual work. Yeah. It's emotional work, because you're abandoning something that was given to you as a gift from your family, from your culture, whatever. And it's tragic to watch. I mean, the paradigmatic example of this is the evangelical who's been raised to think the world is 6,000 years old, who goes to study scripture. And the number of those people who become atheists and agnostics in grad school is really tragic.
Yeah.
But it was just a false conception to start with that set them on the wrong sort of path. And I don't think Protestantism has no resources for dealing with it, but a lot of the people who come out of that in a healthy way find their way into Catholicism, Anglicanism, Eastern Orthodoxy, because in those contexts, the false dichotomy was never there in the first place.
Right. No, I think that's right. I think that's exactly right. Well, I'm going to let you go so you can have some lunch. I'm going to post this tomorrow, and I will include some links to some of the books and things that I talked about in here.
Okay.
And feel free to wade in the comment section. Now, I'm going to warn you that some of the people who watch my channel are going to beat a path to your door, whether that be your email, mailbox, or wherever that is. But after this conversation, there's a group of people who are desperately going to want to engage you more. So,
in a nice way?
Yes, in a nice way.
They're not coming after me with pitchforks and torches?
No, I don't think so. They're going to be really excited about this conversation.
Okay. And, well, you know, if enough, you know, comments come up that give us material for further conversation, I would be happy to engage again. So
I would love it. I can tell that, you know, again, when you sent me an email and I first saw the book, I thought, oh, okay. And I read that first chapter and it was like, oh, this is so important. This is so important. And it's way beyond, well, it's why on earth did the Reformation fight so hard about the sacraments? Well, it was because of everything around it. That's why it's important, not because it's this little piece over here, because it's central to the entire conceptualization of the world and this change that the whole story that we find in the Bible brought to humanity. So,
amen. I think that's a great cap. Yeah, it matters because it's so connected to everything else.
Yeah.
So I really appreciate. I think your reading of my book is going to help other people read it at a deeper level, and I think that's very valuable. So thanks so much.
Okay, Brett, we will talk again. All right.
Awesome. Thanks, Paul.
Bye-bye.
Bye.